when I die, I'm coming back.
I'm drinking some of this. I was over at Jaime's exploding bar mitzvah earlier tonight. And I was drinking some of this Harvey's bristle cream. But you know, it's just a puppet show in the middle of a mirage. That's right. So I just figure I'll pause and swindle. In your fire I shall kindle. You don't get ready to bend over for the Grim Reaper unless you're ready to bend over for the Weekly Reader. You know, the human race is just a self-sufficient rock quarry, fellas, laced with spare parts of a broken-down caboose and a petrified ark in the mud used for splinter harvesting and tooth-plucking. Guys, you know, Pluckhead wasn't just a nickname for the buck-tooth fire engine tomboy. That's right, you know, there's a motto born every minute. And of all the worlds, a stage full of 15-minute stars, a dime a dozen. And Santa Claus is coming to town at halftime for the Super Bowl. Budweiser's gonna burn him at the stake with a lighter fluid and about $500,000 used as the kindling that I was a-swindling. That's right, it's just a horse of a different color, mother. So spike it, pea brain. God damn it, bike it, polka dot vein. And just suck the slime that drains through the collective mind of the Marilyn Monroe doctrine. You know, because blondes, they have more fun with that pig pop art, his scum, in a new zenith. Bends over as a Tamil woman's ass shoots arrows to pop that balloon in the sky you call the sun. When I was over there tonight, tinkling and a-mingling with some of the boys from the office in the back rooms of the industrial phlegm hog wildness, I was thinking to myself, how many more Christmases?
Today. Oh, this is Peter Sellers' one. So now we'll meet again. Vera Lynn and her version of it as well. Uncle Jim, Alan Bishop from Superstars of Greenwich Mean Time. Track's called After Hours. Andy McKay of Roxy Music from his first solo record In Search of Eddie Riff. A song, his cover of the great Skeeter Davis track, The End of the World. The amazing, always amazing, Ill Ease before that from her The After After Party Party EP of 2006. We heard One Hell of a Bender, Foaming Edison with my favorite all-time cover of one of my favorite all-time songs, Wichita Lineman from his See It, Flee It CDR. The Ronettes from a new release called Be My Baby, the very best of the Ronettes. The song is Paradise. New one from Oneida from a split with Pterodactyl, the Green Carter split 12-inch series volume 1, song GTGW. Risto before that, I'm not even going to attempt the song title or the album title. It is, I believe, Finnish. Polystyrene and the album she released I believe it was released the day she died or the day after. It's called Generation Indigo. Very sad. Ghoulish, the song we heard. Peter Elizalde with some mega Todd Rundgren worship on Winter Playground Mystery from an album of the same name. Amandul 2 from Yeti. Archangel's Thunderbird. Hey, hope to see you next week. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope. Worldwide, WFMU.org. My name's Scott. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned. Too Much Information is next. Bye-bye.
Any further, have you accepted Jesus into your life?
Jesus been in my life since I was born. I'm trying to hook up internet service. I'm not trying to hook up to Jesus. I'm already there.
Excuse me?
I'm already there. I'm just trying to get internet service.
Yes, but we're supposed to make sure that you believe in Jesus before we give you any help.
Who don't believe in Jesus? Are you serious?
Well, that you've accepted him to your life, not that you just go to church.
Oh, I know you're kidding. Are you really serious?
Excuse me?
Are you really serious?
What? About accepting Jesus into my life, of course.
No, are you really serious that when people call for internet service, that you tell them they have to accept Jesus into their life?
That's what I just told you, yes. And I should tell you that we are recording this.
Okay, well, you can record it because y'all are not God. But what I'm asking you is, do you do that to everybody that calls? They have to believe in Jesus in order to get internet service?
To get tech support.
I'm saying, I believe in Jesus. Well, what does Jesus have to do with internet service?
Well, that's our company's policy.
When I was in high school, people started giving me comic books. First, this guy Steve gave me his copy of Frank Miller's The Dark Knight. Then my friend Eugene turned me on to Alan Moore's Watchmen. And then, when I was a sophomore in high school, this girl Shannon gave me a copy of Chester Brown's comic book, Yummy Fur. This is the book that did it for me. This book was really something. The main story featured Ed the Happy Clown, this guy who somehow ends up with Ronald Reagan's head on his penis. It wasn't our Ronald Reagan. It didn't look like him at all. It was a Ronald Reagan from another dimension, a dimension that had a serious waste problem. Well, until they found a hole that led to our dimension, which turns out to be some poor dude's anus. But anyways, Chester Brown's imagination is what hooked me on comics, and I've been following his work for decades now. He's still mostly famous for his surrealist masterpiece, Ed the Happy Clown, but as an artist, he's really difficult to label or pin down. He has two books about his childhood that deal with religion, his mother's schizophrenia, and his obsession with Playboy magazines. And in the mid-90s, he wrote and drew Underwater, a story about another world complete with its own language. In 2003, he published a graphic novel about a controversial Canadian historical figure, Louis Riel. His new book is called Paying for It, a comic book memoir about being a John. You see, in 1999, Chester Brown decided that he was done with girlfriends and that instead he would start seeing prostitutes. Paying for It is a very controversial book because not only does Chester Brown argue that prostitution should be legalized and decriminalized, but Paying for It is also a polemic against the idea of romantic love. When his book tour brought him to New York, we got together to talk about some of his ideas about love, sex, and comic books. Paying for It begins in 1996 when his girlfriend Sukyun Lee breaks up with him. Well, she tells him that she wants to have sex with someone else.
Well, essentially, she breaks up with me. And
I think that's a fair thing to say.
Yeah, it's a little bit uncertain at the beginning, but she decided she wanted to get sexually involved with another guy, and our sexual relationship ended, although we continued to live together for many years. And even though I really loved this girlfriend, I had been feeling weird about the whole dynamic of romantic love relationships, about being a boyfriend. And I decided I didn't want to get another girlfriend.
Mm. It seems like your relationship changed once you guys had stopped your sexual relationship. You started to get along better, or are you actually?
Yes,
started...
there were no. We didn't fight anymore. You know, there've been, well, like most boyfriend girlfriend relationships or husband and wife relationships. You know, there were at least occasional arguments. Sometimes very intense and melodramatic, and I found all that very unpleasant. And once we were no longer involved as boyfriend and girlfriend, but just living together as roommates in the same apartment, we just got along way better. And I still loved her. She still loved me. But the relationship just felt so much more comfortable between us. And yeah, I thought, I don't want to go through that again, have another girlfriend that I have to fight with all the time, and you know, deal with all the jealousy and all that sort of stuff.
But you didn't want to be a eunuch. You didn't want to be celibate for the rest of your life. So when you first decided, okay, this is great, I really like my relationship with her now, I'm never doing that again, what was your first conscious, oh yeah, there's that other thing.
Yeah, well, I didn't come to it immediately. There were a couple years after she broke up with me where I was celibate for that time, but eventually, you know, I realized that I don't want to go the rest of my life without having sex ever again, and so I decided to start paying for sex.
Yeah, but how come it's so either or, Chester? It does seem that, you know, I get that there are these two choices you can make here, but there's also casual sex, there's, you know, short-term relationship. I mean, why is it either have a girlfriend or pay for sex?
I just didn't have the social skills necessary to casually pick up women. It was either get a girlfriend or pay for sex. I never had like a one night stand or anything like that. All the sex I'd had was with girlfriends.
And it wasn't like a thought like, well, maybe I should try that first. It was just
that seemed like such a hassle, going to a bar or wherever and trying to pick up women. That seemed like a lot of effort.
Okay, well, why don't you tell us about that initial experience then, which, you know, is comes across in the book. It's a very humorous story. It's very fun. You know, you have all these, you know, thoughts and worries of things that could go wrong.
Oh yeah, I was totally paranoid when I went to pick up the phone to try and make an appointment to see the first prostitute I saw. You know, I was worried that the cops might have these fake phone numbers to flush out John's or something. And so I went and you know, called from a payphone. But then when I went to the place, I was looking under the bed and checking out. When the girl left the room, I checked the washroom and the closets. And
when you get to the door and she opens the door, were you surprised?
I had been worried about whether or not, because I had called, you know, I'd got the phone number from an ad in the back of an alternative weekly, and so there was no photograph to base this on. I just hoped that I would find the woman sexually attractive. And to my delight, when the door opened and she, you know, she was standing there, she was absolutely beautiful. So, but I was still suspicious, like this might be some kind of a setup.
Too good to be true.
Yeah, too good to be true. Maybe this was a sting operation that the cops had set up, or maybe there was a guy in the apartment ready to mug me or something like that. But no, nothing like that happened. She really was a prostitute and a very nice, pleasant person. And I had a great time, even though the sex itself wasn't that great, because I it it felt it had been a couple of years since the last time I'd had sex. It just felt too good. I only lasted like 10 seconds. So, but other than that, the experience was so nice, and she was such a pleasant person. It started off my experiences as a John on a very positive note.
Yeah, I'd love to just read that little bit when you walk out.
Okay, a tip?
So you decided to tip her.
Oh, okay, so she says, a tip, $40? It's not necessary. You don't have to give me anything extra. And then I say, I want to. Even though it didn't last very long, I was totally happy with the whole experience. And then she says in response, you're an angel. Thanks so much. I just moved and that eats up money, so this will really come in handy. Are you going to come see me again? And I say, definitely. Good, I enjoyed meeting you. As I walked out of the brothel, I felt exhilarated and transformed. And then I show myself thinking, it was so honest, up front. It felt natural. A burden that I had been carrying since adolescence had disappeared. The burden has never returned.
And is it true to this day, after you finished the book?
Oh, yeah. I guess the burden had been in large part the difficulty of acquiring sex, that's gone from my life.
Huh. So it seems that the book is almost two things. You seem to be wanting to mount an argument for the decriminalization and legalization of prostitution, and also a polemic against romantic love. And clearly the first, we can understand how that can get in the way of an experience. Like, for example, all of these experiences that you relate are legal.
No. The legal situation in Canada is, I live in Toronto, I should mention. So the legal situation in Canada is a bit different than it is in the States. Prostitution is legal in Canada, but there are laws that control it. So when the John goes to the prostitute's place, whether it's an apartment or a brothel or whatever, that's illegal.
Okay.
That's against the law.
This experience that you just told us about illegal.
That first time I was breaking the law. And also, it's illegal to communicate for the purposes of prostitution in public. And that law is there basically to discourage streetwalking. So basically to pick up a streetwalker on the sidewalk, that's also illegal. But it is legal when the prostitute comes to the John's place, whether it's his home or his hotel room or whatever. Mm-hmm. So in the second half of the book, what I show myself doing is perfectly legal in Canada.
Okay. So the argument for the legalization and decriminalization of prostitution in, these lengthy endnotes to the book, and you quote feminists, you quote sociologists, politicians. Can you talk a bit about how much of the argument actually came from the actual women that you met? Like, how much did they inform the arguments that you make?
They definitely informed it to some degree. Well, particularly at a certain point, I started seeing one particular prostitute who I became very close to, and I actually still see her. And so, yeah, I would ask. I remember asking her one time if prostitution was fully legalized, but one had to acquire a license to be a prostitute. Would she do so? And she said, no way. She just she didn't trust the government with that sort of information, having to give some bureaucrat her full legal name and have her photograph on file and all that sort of stuff. She would continue to work the way she had been, just privately, with no one knowing her business, essentially.
There are many arguments in particulars to, health rules, licensing, black market that you address. The one that I found interesting in the end notes is that you heard a report on the BBC about trafficking, and it was the first time you had consciously even imagined that there could be something like a global sex trade. And, you know, but at the same time, many of the brothels you frequent in the beginning of the book have women who have accents that you are clearly letting us know are not Canadian. And also some of them don't even speak English very well. And I'm curious, you know, at that time, was the idea that there could be something really truly alien to you?
Yeah, there was at least one review that implied that I couldn't have known, or that I should have known, that there was a connection between human trafficking and prostitution. But yeah, I only heard that it was actually a CBC report on the connection between sex slavery and human trafficking and prostitution. I only heard that interview in 2002. And so, yeah, in those early experiences, I didn't even wonder if these girls might be sex slaves or not. It didn't even enter my mind, even when they clearly would have these foreign accents. And it's not like there were a lot of them who had foreign accents. There were only four prostitutes I saw who did. The others either were Canadian or had Canadian accents. So,
yeah.
But I don't see the fact that a woman has a foreign accent as being evidence that she's a sex slave. I think that a woman from another country can choose the work just as much as a Canadian woman can. So,
yeah, I would just say for myself, this is the one area for me just as, that I find a difficult one, perhaps because of what's going on globally and because of these things that we hear in the news.
I'm sure there are some genuine sex slaves out there, but I do think the media does blow it out of proportion. I would say of the foreign prostitutes who are working, it's a small percentage of them are doing it unwillingly.
So how much did the girls you met inform your thinking about the other argument, romantic love? It seems like you discuss this with them sometimes as well.
Oh,
how much
sure.
did they inform your thinking on this?
They didn't really, because usually they have an interest in romance just as much as anyone else in our culture does. They would want to have boyfriends and probably eventually get married. And I show one long debate I have with one of the women who I thought defended the romantic position very well. But yeah, she believed in romantic love and wanted to eventually settle down with a boyfriend. And they can be as romantic as anyone.
Now, many of the arguments and discussions in the book take place between you and your two friends, Seth and Joe Matt, who are also cartoonists. And can you talk about what this trio of individuals sort of significance in the comics world, because for people who read comics, it's like, oh, this is the scene we're all waiting for.
Yeah. Seth and Joe have both done autobiographical comics themselves, and we've all been characters in each other's works. So, although this was the first time I had depicted Seth before in some previous, there were shorter pieces, but I'd never drawn Joe, so this was the first book where I got to actually draw the three of us all together, and it was fun.
Why don't you read us the scene where you decide to tell both Seth and Joe Matt?
Okay. So I begin the conversation. So I had sex the other day, and Joe says, "What? You're joking." And Seth says, "With who?" I say, "A prostitute." Joe says, "No, I don't believe it." Seth says, "Like a streetwalker?" I say, "No, she was in a brothel." And Joe says, "I don't believe it." Seth says, "How did you find a brothel?" And I respond, "An ad in the back of Now," which was an alternative paper is an alternative paper in Toronto. And Joe says, "This is a joke." And I say, "I'm not joking." Joe says, "I was supposed to be next." And I say, "What?" And Joe says, "I've gone without sex for longer than you have. I'm the one who should have been next. That's ridiculous." Joe says, "You cheated. It's not fair." And I say, "It's not like I butted in line ahead of you." Joe says, "It is like that." And I say, "I didn't butt in line in front of you. I left the line you're in, the free sex line, and I walked over to the paying for sex line. You could walk over to the paying for sex line too. It moves a lot faster." So he says, what about the love? And I say, "I don't care about love." And then Joe's last lines in the scene are, "This is disturbing, but it's also good gossip. I won't be able to keep it to myself. Can I tell someone?" And I say, "You can tell anyone you want."
So I think when I ran into Joe Matt around when he was promoting Spent in 2006, I brought up, "So what is Chester working on?" He says, "He's working on his horror book. You haven't heard about this." So I think he did take you up on that.
Oh, yeah. The news about me becoming a John spread very quickly throughout the comic book community.
Yeah,
as a result of Joe blabbing it to everyone.
But at the same time, I think one of the things that's most enjoyable to me in the book is the way you draw Joe in this simmering rage that he has of jealousy. At one point, you even point out an attractive woman and say that she looks like one of the...
Right.
And he threatens to beat your head in with a rock if you say that again.
Yeah, that was... And I remember that scene because it was unusual for Joe, for him to express that sort of violence.
For Joe, his most recent work, Spent, was also set around the same time where he was having troubles with excessive masturbation and porn. He had become a serious porn problem. But again, sort of moving beyond Joe is the individual to a character, perhaps someone who has issues with, getting what they want sexually. It does seem... In a way that, as his friend, you are also, you care about him and you are perhaps showing by example that, there's other ways you can deal with this, Joe.
I kept trying to convince him that he should at least consider paying for sex, but he was he remained resistant to the idea, even though he actually paid for sex at least once in his life. There was a scene in one of his early Peep Show comics where he's in a porn theater and a prostitute approaches him and offers him a blowjob, and I think she maybe wanted $10 or $15 and he bargains her down to $5, so if I remember the scene correctly. Yeah. But
let's talk about Seth. Seth seems to be almost a character that we find, again, not just in the story, but perhaps, concerned civic-minded citizens thinking that they know how this should all work. And by debating him, it becomes clear that he even admits that maybe, I don't know, I'm not sure about that.
Right. Yeah, he takes the point of view that prostitution should be licensed. And I was on the other side saying that it shouldn't be licensed, that it should be, that it really is no one's business but the two people who are involved. Sex should be just between two consenting adults. It's the government and no one else should have any say in what happens. And the idea of licensing sex between consenting adults is just offensive to me. But so he was taking the other position that licensing would make things safer for the girls, and you could also ensure that they get regular health checkups and that sort of thing, to which I argued back.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, on the health side of things, we live in Canada, so people can get health care is free there. So people can get...
Yeah, we don't believe in that here. In Chester.
So people can get... A prostitute, there's no reason why she... She would not be able to get health care if she wanted it. I said to Seth, why would a woman having to get a license make give her any more health care than she can already receive? And he argued back that prostitutes might not get health checkups, and therefore if they even if it's free, they might not go to the doctor, and so therefore they could have VD and be passing it on to their clients.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is by you know, especially if we bring up smoking, it seems that, for example, Seth seems to be articulating something that, you know, if someone hasn't put a lot of thought into the issue of prostitution, just sort of by a knee-jerk reaction says, well, this is, of course this should be regulated, right, or of course this should be licensed, controlled. And, you know, again, for those who don't read comics, Seth is a smoker, you know, a chain smoker. And there seems to be a way in this argument, by you're showing him, you know, with his habitual chain smoking, that you kind of mock sort of the hypocrisy that you know, like maybe like something like smoking should be controlled or regulated, right?
Right, and I kind of back him into a corner where he says that smoking is or at least the manufacture of cigarettes is regulated, but I, you know, I say that even if you know, making cigarettes is regulated, people should still have the right to smoke, even though it's unhealthy for them, even though it's there are negative health consequences for them. People should have the right to make choices that are potentially unhealthy for them, and so that, you know, people should have the right to smoke. And he says, well, maybe people shouldn't have the right to smoke, even though he smokes. He's a heavy smoker.
It seemed as an artistic device, it works really well for, mm-hmm, I think, you know, the argument that you're making. But let's come back to romantic love. You know, one of the things that's most surprising to me in the book is as we're, you know, hurtling towards the end, we learn that you have decided to form a monogamous relationship with a woman you meet, the one that you brought up earlier, Janice. Can you tell us how this happened and when it started?
Well, I didn't intend to start a monogamous relationship. I started seeing this prostitute and I really liked her. And I kept seeing her. And you know, when it was, I just found myself repeating with her and not seeing other prostitutes. I had repeated with other women, but I'd also, whenever I was repeating with a particular prostitute, I would also see other prostitutes too. And so with this particular one, I call her Denise in the book, I ended up just wanting to see her, not finding myself desiring other women or wanting to see other prostitutes.
Yeah, but the way you even draw the scenes in the book, the earlier ones, it's kind of like, wow, this guy's kind of in love. You know, it's like I think you have a point where you actually said there's something different about her. There's something special. And you know, as I'm reading this book, you know, watching your argument against romantic love play out, I think the problem for me is it just seems like, whoa, this is a big bombshell that I need a little more info to understand how the argument plays out.
Well, like, I've been seeing her for 8 years. I saw her a couple times, and then I saw a couple other prostitutes, and then I went back to seeing her. And then, so I've been monogamous with her for 7 years now, yeah. At a certain point, she decided to stop seeing other clients, and she had had boyfriends too during the time she had worked as a prostitute, but she broke up with her last boyfriend, and so we ended up becoming monogamous. She's been monogamous with me for 4 years, so we're kind of exclusive sex partners now.
Sounds like a relationship to me.
It could sound that way. I think even though we're sexually monogamous, I still do pay her for sex, and I think that somehow changes the dynamic of the relationship in some way. I think if I wasn't paying her, if she said, let's move this into a more conventional romantic relationship type territory and you don't have to pay me anymore, I think that probably would, I mean,
Let's back up, though, because there are plenty of men who have girlfriends who they give them money for.
And yes. It's,
you know, I mean, I just don't know if that's so unconventional. Like, that, when you say,
perhaps,
like, moving it into a conventional thing, I think there are a lot of guys who have a girlfriend who expects to get money often.
Maybe. But I don't know. This relationship definitely feels different than the relationships I had with girlfriends. Although we can occasionally disagree or even get into the occasional argument, those arguments never reach the sort of melodramatic intensity that the fights I would have with girlfriends reached, you know.
And the magic ingredient here is money, you're saying.
I think it changes the relationship in some way. I can't be sure. Maybe she just is someone who I really get along with in a way that I didn't get along with my girlfriends. I don't know. But for whatever reason, the relationship really works.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems that, you know, the exclusivity thing is also something I think that left me a little confused, because I think one of the things you discover early on by, you know, frequenting the different women you meet in the book is that you seem to really like to be in control. That, well, okay, I'll see this person now, or I'm interested in, you know, you read a review, you discover the there's an actual review website where,
right,
other Johns.
Yeah, there are several websites where Johns write reviews of prostitutes, and they write these reviews for other Johns, letting them know if the women, I don't know, look like their photos on the internet or whatever. If that's that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a particular one devoted to prostitution in Toronto called Turb.ca. So that's the one I would refer to.
Yeah. So, you know, in the middle of the book, as you are meeting different women, you seem, you know, to be having a very healthy, you know, happy sex life, as you say to Joe Matt time and time again. And, you know, the exclusivity part seems confusing in that, like, that seems like one of the benefits of why you chose to make this decision in the first place. And giving that up seems like giving something up. But perhaps that's just me thinking that, and that's not how it was for you.
Giving up the option of seeing other women?
Yeah.
But I could. At least Denise has told me that if I did want to see other women, that would be fine with her. I just don't want to. So I have that freedom if I wanted to exercise it. But she's so wonderful that at this point there is no interest on my part in seeing other prostitutes.
Like, would you feel like you were cheating on her if you had like an encounter?
Yes, I probably would. Even though she claims she wouldn't see it that way, I would feel like I was cheating on her. So, I doubt that I would. If someone I found attractive did offer herself sexually to me, I doubt I would take her up on it. Just, I wouldn't feel right about it.
Oh, yeah. And I guess, you know, since we have so many arguments, it's really well-articulated ones against romantic love, this is where I get confused, because when you say this burden has been lifted, it seems that, like, you shouldn't have to worry about or have this feeling, right?
Actually, the last time I saw her, we were talking about this and how people seem to be trying to impose a romantic reading on our relationship. And she said that she feels like the reason why our relationship works is because it doesn't feel like there's, how did she put it? I'm going to paraphrase here, but like there's a heavy intensity to our relationship. Mm-hmm. It feels light and pleasant, not heavy and dramatic. So,
but you can see how a reader might, you know, project a romantic reading about your 7-8 year monogamous relationship, mm-hmm, that you would feel bad if you hooked up with someone else's relationship.
Right.
I mean,
oh, definitely.
Okay,
sure. Especially since our whole culture thinks that way or pushes that idea. If there's an available man who's, and there's an available woman, I don't know, fate should bring them together or whatever. You know, we project romantic readings on well, all the time on things.
And I think also I would say for the audience that I think one of the issues that complicates this is that not only with Denise but with all the women in the book, you're really going out of your way to respect their privacy mm-hmm. and leaving out a lot of details. So it's not just your story, it is her story at this point as well. And so it does seem that perhaps complicates the end.
Yeah, I wish I could have gone into more detail about our relationship and how it works she told me at one point, put me in the book as little as possible. So I tried to respect her wishes. And there were certain scenes that I thought were kind of crucial and would help to make things more clear. And I asked her, can I show this scene or can I show that scene? And she nixed all of those.
So at the end, today, right now, are you still a John?
I'm not sure what to call because I don't consider Denise a prostitute.
She's your girlfriend.
I don't know what to call her. I actually have called her my girlfriend in interviews, but just because I can't think of a better thing to call her, and I put air quotes around the word girlfriend, Yeah, at least by some dictionary definitions, a prostitute is someone who has sex with paid sex with multiple partners. And in this situation, it's not multiple partners. It's we're exclusive with each other. So some people might consider her a prostitute, and I'm not going to argue that. That's fine.
What about you?
Yeah, I actually probably do consider myself a John because I know that if or when this relationship with Denise ends, I'm going to be paying for sex again. I'll be back on Turb looking up reviews and trying to find someone who's good, and I'll find a prostitute to have sex with. That probably is what defines my sex life now, is paying for it.
If you put all your work on one shelf, it seems that it's very difficult to say exactly what kind of cartoonist you are. It's such a wide, amazing range, from historical work to autobiographical work to surrealist work. When you describe yourself as, when someone who's not familiar with work says, what kind of cartoons, as a woman does in the you meet in paying for it, how do you answer that these days? Is it just what you're working on at the time, or do you have a definition of like what kind of cartoonist you are?
Usually people aren't that curious. They don't get that deep into the subject. If someone asks me what I do, I say I'm a cartoonist, and if they further inquire, I say I write and draw graphic novels. And it doesn't usually go beyond that. But if I was to say, I would probably, you give that example of that, talking to that first prostitute. In that conversation, I said, I think just that my work is very personal. And all the work is personal to me, even a work like my book about Louis Riel. Even though it's not about my life and it's about a historical figure, the subject and my interest in Canadian history is mm-hmm. personal. I mean, that's...
You told me that you wanted to piss the Canadian government off or make them look bad, I think, early on.
Right, yeah.
But Ed the Happy Clown, your first book, is still your best known. And Drawn and Quarterly recently put out a 9 comic book re-serialization of it. And in those notes, we learn that you actually are still messing around with it, redrawing it and rewriting some stuff.
I was going to try to do that after I finished my book about Riel, I sat down to I've never liked that first book, and of course that's not unusual for writers to you know, not be crazy about their first novel or whatever. But I decided that rather than reprint Ed the Happy Clown, I wanted to completely rewrite and redraw it. So I sat down to try to do that, and I wrote a full script of a whole new version of Ed, and I sat down and started drawing it, and I drew, I think, like 100 pages of pencils.
Okay.
Those 100 pages didn't take me to the end of the book. I realized at a certain point, this is no better than the first version. It's different, but it's not better. And so at that point, I was like, this is pointless. I'm wasting my time here.
And it took you how long to figure that out?
Well, I finished the Riel book in 2003, and I began this current book, Paying for It, in 2006. So it was sometime in that three-year period. It didn't take me all of 3 years. I think I've worked on some other projects in there, some freelance stuff and whatnot. But
Another connection I made to your earlier work with Paying for It was The Playboy, which was a young Chester Brown who has a burden of his, you know, just sexuality, reading Playboy and having, you know, serious problems, you know, burying the magazine in the field after masturbating to it. But there was a scene when you go to the field and you're imagining, you know, your teacher watching you through binoculars, just as you're on the bike imagining, oh, you know, the cop's going to bust me today. But it seemed that this was a burden that you had a lot more difficulty. But then there's not only age, which is an issue, but it was religion. It seems like religion is something completely missing from Paying for It.
Yeah. I still am religious, and actually during the years that I created it, I would have defined myself as a Christian, although I don't now.
It's a back and forth thing?
I suppose, yeah. But it didn't seem to relate to the story in any way, although I'm sure there are people out there wondering, how can you be a Christian and also pay prostitutes for sex?
Yeah, I think there might be some people might ask that, Chester. One or two, maybe? Three? And what was...
of course, it depends on which writer you're referring to, but there are interpretations of the Bible or interpreters who would argue that the Bible never really condemns prostitution. The Apostle Paul has a famous section in the New Testament where he says never visit a prostitute or something like that, or I can't remember the exact wording, but I read a book by a woman named Kathy Gacka called The Making of Fornication, in which she argues that all of Paul's writings against fornication and prostitution have been misinterpreted, that really he was condemning relationships between pagans and Christians, that he didn't want pagans and Christians having sex together and getting involved together. And it's she makes what I thought was a convincing case. I'm not sure if she's correct, but
yeah. But I think for someone who's left maybe religion or Christianity behind, you know, these arguments are relevant. But for someone who's defining themselves as a Christian while they're writing this, and especially for someone with a background where religion played such a major role, and again, if I think back to the Playboy, I mean, I think it wasn't just, you know, just puberty and growing up. That it was a very large religious influence that affected you as a young man and some of the things that you were going through in that book, it would be fair to say. So it seems interesting that, you know, that just didn't, you know, you didn't want to include that at all.
Yeah, well, I guess I'd, even though I still defined myself as a Christian, I'd left behind my childhood conception of Christianity. I just saw Christianity in a different way.
You know, I grew up in a pretty religious household too, and you know, I think one of the things that attracted me early on to Yomi Furr and your work was your work on the Gospels. Mm-hmm. You know, and this continued. You did all of Mark. I think you got to 20 on Matthew 20?
Yeah, I'm pretty... I got close to the end in Matthew. I was right at the point where Jesus was about to enter Jerusalem, which is, of course, his final days.
Yeah. And what? You stopped?
Well, I wanted to focus on the Riel book. And one of my reasons for wanting to adapt the Gospels was because it was a good way to learn more about Christianity and about... one of my reasons for wanting to do that material was to wrestle with what it meant to be a Christian, and the more I worked on them, the more I knew about the Gospels, so. That was part of it, and so probably by the point where I gave up working on Matthew, I probably felt I had resolved those sorts of issues. So I felt I didn't need to continue from a personal level. Mm-hmm. I didn't need to continue with it.
Hmm.
Although my thinking did progress from there, and as I just mentioned, you know, I'm no longer a Christian, so obviously my thinking hadn't been completely settled. But
another thing I learned in the notes to the new Ed the Happy Clown is that you were actually not very politically engaged as a young man when you were doing that. In fact, you joke how you thought that, you know, waste removal would be a federal issue, not a municipal.
Right.
And now that seems completely changed. You even ran in an election recently. Can you talk about your engagement with politics today?
Yeah, as a result of doing the Riel book, I became a libertarian. Got involved with the Libertarian Party in Canada. And in the 2008 federal election, I ran I ran to try to become a member of parliament, lost by a huge margin. Got only a pathetic 490 votes, but despite that, I ran in the most recent federal election, which was just a few months ago, or not even that. It was, at the beginning of 2011, and once again lost. But I got even fewer votes than the first time I ran, but.
As an anarchist, which I think you at one point described yourself in a letters column, it seemed like you were engaged in a different... I mean, in other words, a libertarian requires almost more of an engagement.
I suppose. Libertarianism is very similar to anarchism in that there's a huge distrust of the role of government in society. Mm. But we still see government as necessary to some degree. So
I do think it's important to point out that you got a grant for your book in terms of necessary. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I actually got two grants from the Canada Council for the Arts, which is a branch, of course, of the Canadian government. The money is supplied by the Canadian government anyways. And...
Isn't it important for libertarians to reject those kind of grants when they're offered?
I don't see it that way. A lot of people would see it as hypocritical to say that government shouldn't give money to artists. And but on the other hand, to be an artist who accepts money from the government.
There might be one or two people that think that.
But to me, hypocrisy is when you say one thing and do another. to me, the difference is if I've never condemned any artist for accepting money from the Canada Council. I think government shouldn't be giving the money, but it's okay for people to take the money if the money is being given. It's the difference between giving and taking. So to me, there's no hypocrisy there, although it may look bad.
Yeah, it just seems that, you know, since, I mean, your own experience, you were able to make this piece of art, and that grant helped make that happen.
Yeah, it worked out well for me, but I don't think... I understand, particularly with this book, why there might be people who would be upset with the government.
It is pretty great that the government gave you money to go frequent escorts.
Right. And I don't think I was owed that money in any way. I took advantage of the system, but why... Why should the government...
It's just so hard to understand that, though, Chester. It really is. It's just very difficult to understand, like, how you can keep both. I mean, I'm just going in one ear and out the other. It seems like hogwash. I mean, it's like, how can you take money and admit that it's helped and it's great and, you know, and then at the same time condemn that?
It benefited me, but... That money came from someone else who might have been able to use the money in a better way. I can assure you that if I was elected, I would speak out against grants from the government. And
I'm sure every cartoonist we know now is going to get behind you on that one.
I would not be popular in the artistic community for advocating that position. But to me, that's where the test of hypocrisy would be if I actually did get elected and what I would do then.
Let's end with autobiographical comics. It seems that when you finished with Ed the Happy Clown, you know, you obviously started doing the ones about your childhood, but then you went into, I mean, two of my favorite stories were just, you know, your roommate's situation in the rooming house. You were living in Toronto. And it seemed, again, though, that one of the main features, partly because we're talking about cartoonists who aren't very active, it's very passive. You know, the characters are very, very passive. And, you know, and again, not a lot of stuff interesting happens. You know, there was, you know, a lot of jokes being made about the genre in the late 90s, early 2000s, about how this genre had played itself out, and that, you know, like the autobiographical stories of the cartoonist who whines about, you know, not getting a girlfriend or masturbating or, you know, walking around, you know, feeling lonely.
Right.
It's kind of been done. And it seems that you kind of one-upped everybody and that you have an autobiographical story that's just kind of a lot of stuff happens and it's not very passive. I mean, this is a very not only a very different Chester Brown, you know, in terms of this active, but it's also a story where you get to draw a lot of sex. You have a lot, you know, a lot of excitement.
I hope it's exciting to readers. I personally felt like I had gone as far as I could with autobiographical stuff. And when I finished I Never Liked You. So I didn't foresee going back to the genre, but yeah, with this, then I started paying for sex, and it looked like this was going to make an interesting book. Yeah.
This episode of Too Much Information is called The Difference Between Giving and Taking, a conversation with Chester Brown. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen. Special thanks to Jason Siegel. Chester Brown's book, Paying for It, is published by Drawn and Quarterly. On the TMI show page, you'll find links and images, and that's where you can subscribe to the TMI podcast. All that at WFMU.org.